Je vais devenir chèvre, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is French for I will become a goat, or more literally, I am going insane, because we actually had a good race at Paul Ricard. Special thanks to Danny O'Dwyer, who directly taunted the F1 gods for this. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, we have Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Doing my best to keep up with the conversation, given my fine Comcast internet. But we'll see how this goes.
Yes, I'm hearing you over the telephone, which is wild. But yeah, we'll do our best here. Danny O'Dwyer is on assignment, but we've got quite a bit to talk about. Not only the French Grand Prix, but also the upcoming Austria Grand Prix, because we've got one race down of a 3-race triple header week to week to week. So if you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome. And if you're new to Formula One itself, we've got an episode just for you. Our preseason primer assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains everything about how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go and listen to that, that's episode 137. Also, the show is supported entirely by our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos exclusively for those patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you'd like to support the show and get access to all of that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. There's also a link to the primer episode as well. This month on Patreon, we will be discussing the short film Le Mans 1955, which is free to watch on YouTube, and we will link that in the show notes as well. Today, though, as mentioned, the French Grand Prix was actually good, Rob.
Against all odds.
Yeah, it started, I guess qualifying wasn't that crazy, I guess... Depending on your perspective, the top two maybe was Max Verstappen on pole by almost 0.3 of a second over Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas, and then Sergio Perez in fourth. Carlos Sainz started fifth, Pierre Gasly in sixth, Charles Leclerc in seventh, Lando Norris in eighth, Fernando Alonso in ninth, and Daniel Ricciardo in 10th. Behind them, we've got Esteban Ocon, Sebastian Vettel, Antonio Giovinazzi in 13th place, George Russell in 14th, and Mick Schumacher, the first time he has gotten to Q2, although he did crash in Q1, so that nixed some other driver's laps. Maybe that's why he got to Q2, but he was there just the same. And just to round out the rest of the field here, Nicholas Latifi in 16th, followed by Kimi Raikkonen, Nikita Mazepin, Lance Stroll, and then Yuki Tsunoda. Yuki Tsunoda red flagged Q1 by spinning and hitting the wall. That kind of it broke his gearbox. So he had to change the gearbox and incur a penalty. So he started from the pit lane. And his crash also... So Lance Stroll's laps were invalidated by track limits. They were disturbed by Tsunoda and then Schumacher. So he didn't set anything because of those three things, and thus was out at the end of Q1 and started from the back of the grid, technically, because Tsunoda started from the pit lane.
Yeah, it was an extremely cursed session for Stroll, and you could hear the frustration getting to everyone when with their last chance he was asking, so should I go fast on this lap? And his crew chief was, you know, telling him, yes, you haven't set a time. And so you've got to go. It didn't matter, because again the red flag got him, and as well, it was tough seeing Tsunoda have another bad incident. It was,
yeah,
like, it wasn't the worst mistake we've seen, but they are starting to add up. And also, I guess you could say that if he's having trouble keeping the car under control, he probably shouldn't be attacking curbs that aggressively. And that's kind of what upset him, was that he really went hard at not just the curb, but the so you get the red and white striped curb, but then at some parts of the track you have the sausage curbs, those little like you know, highlighter yellow speed bumps almost. And when the cars go over those, they really do upset the footing of the car, and it takes a minute to sort of regather it. And Tsunoda didn't have a minute. He had to make the next corner right away, and he couldn't. And so the thing just boomeranged on him, and then he was a passenger reversing into the wall. Weird accident.
Yeah, and it was funny watching it in slow motion, because the car, and both the commentators remarked on this, it kind of did this shimmy that could not have been good for the internals. And sure enough, his gearbox broke. And I think David Croft referred to it as a twerking motion, which I don't think I ever want to hear David Croft say again. But yes, I feel like...
And yet it was undeniable.
It's very true. Tsunoda, I don't know. I saw a headline. I didn't read the article, but AlphaTauri is, I think the phrase was, keeping the faith with Tsunoda, which I'm pleased to see, because, I mean, I like the guy. He's a rookie. Yeah, he has crashed a few more times than the other rookies in the field, but... I'd like to see what he can do once he works out the kinks.
Yeah.
But let's take it to the start, shall we? You want to take this or shall I?
Yeah, I got it.
Okay.
So it's an interesting start. Everyone gets away from the line pretty cleanly. Perez is a little sluggish coming off the line. Max has an okay start. Bottas probably has the best looking start, but he has nowhere really to go with it. And so he maintains contact with the leaders, but can't do a lot. But things are immediately sort of upset by the fact that Max stays ahead of Hamilton heading into turn one. But as we were just discussing, going over the curbs too hard can upset the balance of the car. Max goes over the curb hard heading into one, and you can see he kind of loses it, and he basically can't make the next turn, and so he goes straight through turn two around the outside of these bollards that are set up, and he has to rejoin behind Hamilton and just ahead of Bottas, and so immediately he's he's kind of thrown away the lead. It's an exciting start elsewhere. Further down, Ricardo has a really dramatic start. He gets outside of his teammate Norris at turn one, fends off Esteban Ocon a moment later, and is pretty aggressively on Leclerc's gearbox. So it's an exciting start to the race for Ricardo. Alonso is eventually the person who ends up right behind Leclerc. Also can't quite do it. So it seems like an auspicious start for the Ferraris. It's probably the highlight of their day for where things are going from here. They managed to end up holding position pretty well at the start. So there's a lot of action at the start. Ocon sort of gobbles up Norris as well. Norris just doesn't come off well at the start of this race. He's kind of squeezed by his teammate, and that kind of set a stage for, I feel like he kind of felt that Ricardo wasn't showing him, wasn't giving him enough space, certainly at the start. And then a bit later, he also felt like Ricardo was a bit sharp elbowed. Stroll ended up making a pretty good recovery start from the back of the grid. Ended up cleaning up some of those back markers and getting closer to where an Aston should be. Tsunoda stalled the car coming out of the pits when he got the green light. Yeah, well, didn't stall it, but like he couldn't find the gear, and so he's told, he's given the go ahead to go. And the car lurches and stops dead, and it takes another like 2 seconds to get rolling again. So it was, Tsunoda's tough race continued. But Norris and Ricardo were sort of battling all the way around the first lap into the second lap. Norris took one last shot at Ricciardo heading into turn one and two. Couldn't do it. But the other thing is, all the drivers are on the radio complaining about poor grip. It had rained overnight. The temperatures were cooler. And so you had a number of drivers in those early laps immediately telling their teams, hey, these conditions are not what we thought they were going to be. And I think a thing that was easy to underestimate was that basically the tire strategies that teams were predicting were going to be workable for race day really weren't. And it was kind of the real race on Sunday, I would say, was kind of which teams were going to figure that out, right? Which teams were going to figure out what the actual race day dynamics were going to be versus what they were scripted to be.
Yeah, I think as you said, the temperatures, the fact that it rained and washed away all of the rubber that had been laid down beforehand. I think it was also a little exacerbated by the fact that the track had been recently resurfaced, I think in January. So it was all very, very smooth and thus nothing for the tires to grip. And I think there was some decent wind. I think there was a tailwind that may have exacerbated Verstappen's move into that first corner as well. So all sort of contribute to low grip conditions or just it being difficult to keep the car going straight. And when that happens, the tires start to, especially the front tires, start to scrub across the track, and that wears them much more. That especially happened with the Ferraris, as you said, but that sort of rears its head around lap 15. Before that, though, Alonso starts to fade around lap 11. He also is complaining about tire trouble and is passed by Ricciardo down the inside at the chicane. And then on the same lap by Norris with a huge lunge down the inside of that long right hander. I thought that was a great move.
Yeah, I mean, it was surprising how fast it just went away from Alonso. Like, that had been a close fight for a number of laps. And then it was just like, you could see just the moment the car gave up the ghost, right? And suddenly, like, Ricciardo could close the deal. And then Alonso, in that turbulence, was just easily dusted by Norris. I want to go back real quick to something, just because there was a little fallout from it. Did you see Mazepin push Schumacher wide at a corner and force him through the exit road?
I don't think I did.
Yeah, so around turn five, and mind you, this is like P19, P20, right? So it's thoroughly in a, this is just for pride of place within the team. But yeah, Schumacher was, you know, trying to take the apex on a corner, and Mazepin just like did not give him any space and forced him to run all the way through. It was one of those places in the course where there's an assigned, if you can't make the turn, you have to go find a little exit road and rejoin elsewhere. So Schumacher did end up having to do that. And there's, again, like, increasing bad blood. Schumacher after the race said it doesn't have to be like that. I'll have to talk to the team again. If at the end of the day, if that's the way it has to be, then that's the way it has to be. We'll do our thing. I think he's doing his. But yeah, already that relationship is just poisonous. And this comes after, of course, you know, Schumacher basically said like Mazepin tried to kill them both at Baku with a late and really irresponsible block. You know, the thing is, the incident at Paul Ricard, I don't think it did look that egregious. It was just some, you know, hard racing, the 2-into-1 situation. But body of work, you know, Mazepin is very easy to make the heel in all these situations. And certainly Schumacher seems to have reached that conclusion himself. So good drama, good vibes down at Haas.
Yeah, for sure. Oh boy.
Well, I was just going to say, cause we're entering the pit, dynamics here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this next part of the race gets real interesting because kind of one of the things that we're left wondering is like, should Mercedes have been reading the tea leaves a little bit better? Right. And so we have some of these passes happening, Alonso sort of giving up the ghost. But the leaders have been racing really closely throughout all this, right? Like the leading pack, they don't really break away from each other. Verstappen is not that far off Hamilton. Bottas is not that far off Verstappen throughout all of this. Lap 13, Bottas does have a little off and on, and he loses a second to Verstappen. And then lap 15, Leclerc is kind of the first of like the leading teams to call an early pit stop. The originally projected pit window was from Pirelli, laps 18 to 25. Little bit of context. The teams were running higher pressures this week. Pirelli's not saying anything was wrong with their tires recently. But just to be on the safe side, they changed their guidance for tire pressures. But conditions are very different on race day. Leclerc is bringing it in a few laps before what would have been considered the early edge of the pit window. He goes to hards, comes out in P19. And from there, we've got a lot of people. It's starting to dawn on them that the undercut might be pretty strong here. And I think one of the real tells is lap 17, Ricardo goes into the pits, and they explicitly say box to overtake Gasly. So they're calling the undercut, and it works, you know, works like a dream. Basically he comes out, and he has made up, I think, two spaces, in there. He's ahead of both Gasly and Sainz when he comes out. And that's how the undercut was working on Sunday.
Yeah, it is especially strong here. And just to explain for some new listeners, the undercut's kind of, it can be difficult to wrap your head around, but basically, like, so just to point out Ricardo and Gasly, Ricardo was behind Gasly on track, but then he came in before Gasly for new tires, hoping that on those new tires, he would be going around the circuit faster than Gasly was on his old tires. So that when Gasly came in to pit, Ricardo had made up enough time by going faster that when Gasly came out of the pit, Ricardo was ahead of him. And that, yeah, seems to be something that Red Bull especially is looking at closely and chooses to capitalize on, because lap 19, just a few laps later, they pit Verstappen from second place, hoping to jump Hamilton. Although, I guess there is another wrinkle here. Bottas pits before that, probably to try to undercut Verstappen, and then Verstappen immediately on the next lap comes in to kind of cover that off. Because again, if you think about it, if Bottas is lapping on new tires faster, you want to nip that in the bud as fast as you can so that Bottas doesn't overtake you when you have to pit. So Bottas pits, then Verstappen. Go ahead.
Well, and I'll add one other thing, because again, like, there's a lot of criticism directed at Mercedes later, but I will say, around the same time where Bottas is in the pits about to come out, Verstappen is about to be brought in, Hamilton is on the radio saying his tires still feel okay. And so even though, like, you're going to have a lot of Mercedes drivers pretty pissed at the end of the race about, like, where the strategy has left them, in the moment, and it is important to remember, like, these teams have, like, literal minutes, seconds to make these decisions. Like, when Hamilton could have said, like, hell, we need to go to a two-stop, he kind of waffles. And after sort of being shaky on his tires throughout the early part of the race, or at least saying he is, you know, suddenly he felt more confident in them. At probably the last moment, he could have called the two-stop ahead of Red Bull. And once Verstappen comes in lap 19, at that point, like, Mercedes has lost a little bit of the ability to dictate the race. I guess the one thing I'd say, though, is the Ricardo pit stop to me did feel like a canary in the coal mine with just how strongly the undercut was working. And they did have a lap of pace to react to that. And they kind of stuck to their guns And yeah, when they brought in Hamilton on lap 20, he came out just behind Verstappen, and the race was completely recast. Perez stayed out. They put Perez on sort of the, this is the other thing, Red Bull split strategy, and Perez was committed early to this, you know, to this long first stint, while Max was given sort of the optimal tires. So that was another difference between the way the two teams approached this.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. I didn't hear this during the race, but in some of the videos that F1 has on their YouTube channel, when Hamilton is in the pits and is after the tire change, he's rolling through the pit lane, and his engineer, Bono, tells him, okay, Verstappen should be behind 1.5. Like, you will be ahead of Verstappen by a second and a half, is what that means. And then when he comes out of the pits, it's like a drag race that Verstappen gets the better of, and gets in front of Lewis. And then Bono has to come back and say, okay, Lewis, not sure what happened there, mate.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, Mercedes's computer models said that they'd be okay. So they were completely surprised by the fact that Verstappen jumped them in the pits. And I think it just came down to the fact that Verstappen blitzed his in lap before he came in. They had a good stop, I think just a few tenths faster than Mercedes. And then he blitzed his out lap too. So that Red Bull, I guess, is really good with either switching on the tires, or Verstappen is just magical or something. I think it was 3 seconds that Verstappen was behind Hamilton when he first came into the pits. So he made up that amount of time with the undercut, which is crazy.
So just in terms of counterfactuals, keep this in mind. Norris sticks to a pretty aggressive one-stop strategy. He comes in on lap 25 for his hard. So he waits out pretty much that entire first pit stop window to stick by the one-stop strategy that Pirelli had kind of been predicting at the start of the weekend. And that's just an interesting data point in comparison, and I think because of where he was in traffic and just the pace of that car, it's probably not a great comparison for what was happening with the leaders, but still, like, bear that in mind, that Norris is kind of running that originally scheduled one-stopper. And we'll see how that all pans out. But I'll tell you, like, even though we get, like, you could look at this and say it's a bit of a processional phase of the race. Now, there's throughout this race, there's some decent midfield and back marker action. But Verstappen never made a clean getaway. Like, again, the Mercs were, like, full in attack mode and keeping a grip on the back of him. Now, the thing is, though, it doesn't take too long. You know, lap 31, Verstappen is on the radio saying tires are struggling. Bottas is on the radio saying the car can't finish like this. He is basically saying that, like, the one stop that they've drawn up is not going to work. And Mercedes' response is basically to tell him, like, you got to do it. This is what we need. And so the thing is, this is probably the last moment where Mercedes can get ahead of Red Bull's, like, decision making. And I kind of wonder, like, it's kind of a race to see who is going to pull that trigger first, right? Mm-hmm. And it proves to be Verstappen. I think Mercedes were thinking about it, and Verstappen goes in for the second stop on lap 33. Not that far. You know, not that much more racing has occurred. He goes in early to get back on the mediums that he was liking. And at that point, Mercedes is so flat-footed that, you know, they're on the radio. I don't know when this message hit Lewis, but they ask him somewhere around there, we have 21 laps remaining, let us know what you think. And Lewis is kind of like, well, the fronts are in bad shape, but what are we going to do? And the thing this reminded me of is, I feel like we had this conversation, like, last year, where when you are at a disadvantage in race pace, it's real easy for teams and drivers to start looking stupid because you kind of start having to do things that are a little bit like counter strategy and just hoping that they're going to work out, even though the smart money would probably not be on them. And I feel like this was the race where I was like, oh, Mercedes kind of looking up here, because at every turn, they're not confident that they can just win this thing in a straight fight. And so they're like, oh, the drivers don't like the one stop, but we don't see how we can do a two. So we're just going to have them keep that track position and pray.
Yeah, I think the other thing here is that you're right. Since Verstappen pits from the lead, Hamilton can't pit after him because he'll not only come out behind Verstappen, he'll also come out behind Perez. So Hamilton may have tried to undercut Verstappen on a two-step strategy, but now because Red Bull moved first, they've kind of forced Mercedes to leave Hamilton out. So now Red Bull has to, or Verstappen has to, chase down Hamilton and eat up those 20 or so seconds in 20 laps and then be able to pass.
There's this point where, Hamilton early on, he realizes, well, okay, now that us sort of dictating the two stop is off the table, he's asking on lap 36, is he going to catch me?
Yeah.
And the response is, it depends on how long it takes him to get past Bottas. Meanwhile, Bottas is basically on the radio being like, car sucks, I hate it. And so, like, the entire thing, it's like the reverse of a lot of races we've seen where, like, Hamilton has been the guy just inexorably eating up distance to a wounded Red Bull trying to hold track position. And now, like, the shoe is fully on the other foot, and Hamilton is there basically praying, like, well, I hope Valtteri can find something to do with this. In the meantime, again, just point of comparison, Norris is kind of slashing through the field. Lap 34 easily gets past Ricardo. And so it's all going pretty smoothly. Perez takes team orders like a champ. Let's Verstappen by around the same time. And so we built toward this like pursuit of Bottas through like the low 40s lap count. And the hope, I guess, is that not just that like Verstappen will be sort of stuck behind him a fair bit, but also that those tires will be used up in the act of overtaking Bottas. But the problem is, you can just see, I watched this on replay, Bottas's car is so finished by this point. And the real tell is, so he gets dinged because it looks like he gets outplayed heading into turn eight, that he overcommits to defend the inside line on the Mistral Straight, and Verstappen just cuts outside of him. But I think that's actually not what's really going on. I don't think his defensive move was a mistake. The issue I'm seeing when I look at Bottas in these replays is that he's got all the markers of a car that's on bad tires now. He can't get a clean exit from these corners. You look at their speed on these straights, and Max is holding a higher speed through the corner, and then he's accelerating sooner. And so it really is just inevitable. I don't think there's anything Bottas can do, because like at no point can he even get on the gas at the same time that Max can. He is always like a beat behind him because he no longer trusts those tires to put any power through them if the steering wheel's turned even a little bit. And so like he looks like a schmuck, I think, the way Verstappen sort of dusts him. But I look at that and I'm like, no, there are too many places at every point on the lap where he just had to give up pace to Verstappen. And if it hadn't happened there, it was going to happen like 3 seconds later.
Yeah, I mean, they're showing the deficit, like Hamilton to Verstappen, and Verstappen's eating Hamilton into Hamilton's lead by about a second a lap. And Bottas' tires are two laps older than Hamilton's. So he has even less ammo to fight at the end of the race here. Once that happens, Valtteri lets his team know how displeased he is.
Yeah. Why the fuck don't you listen to me when I said it was going to be a two-stopper? My tires are fucking finished. Yeah. And the team, in the fallout of this, people are like, you know, ooh, is there going to be fallout from Valtteri speaking that way over the radio? And the team is very much like, nah, it's fine. It's justified. And, you know, we love to see that spirit. I think this is kind of the boardroom asshole persona of Mercedes sometimes that I think kind of comes from Wolf. I think they like to sort of lean into this idea of like they have a real frank and aggro culture. After this race, you know, the way Mercedes responds to every setback is you will see a clip where like Toto will be up there being like, you know, these setbacks, they just motivate us more. We are going to embrace this challenge and we are going to unlock the secrets of hustle culture and come back stronger next time. Like, that's kind of Mercedes. And I think that's kind of why, like, Valtteri can blow up on the radio. It helps that Valtteri was right. Like, you can go back 30 laps and he's saying this is how it's going to go. And Mercedes' strategy is like, nah, we think we got this. And they don't.
Yeah, so Perez also gets Bottas in the same place a few laps later for that final podium spot. And I didn't catch this the first time around, but at the end of that move, Perez went way wide after that, well outside of the white line. And Mercedes assumes that Perez is going to get a 5-second penalty for this, which is why they don't pit Bottas for the fastest lap, because he had enough time back to the fifth place runner, who was, I believe, Norris, to pit Bottas and still come out in fourth place and maybe get an extra point for fastest lap. But Wolf said after the race to Autosport, we thought maybe Perez gets a penalty for overtaking outside of track limits, so we said stay within 5 seconds to Bottas. It was really balancing between that penalty or making the fastest lap. We gambled, we lost. The stewards, however, determined, quote, that Perez had fully completed the pass on Bottas by the time he left the track at turn 10. This made the fact that he left the track subsequently as a standard track limits question, and therefore not an overtaking penalty. That's from race fans, by the way. So yeah, the next four laps are us watching to see if Verstappen can catch Hamilton by the end and whether Hamilton will be able to hold him off on those old tires. And in the end, there's nothing really that Hamilton can do. Verstappen just breezes by, really, into another win. And yeah, like you said, Rob, the strategist James Vowles over the radio told Hamilton, this one's on us, owning up to their failed strategy.
Well, and Hamilton, you know, did also let his team off the hook a little bit, where he was like, at a certain point, it did feel like they just had to stick to the one stop, and that was the only chance. And in fairness, like, that pass happens on the next to last lap, right? And so it's one of those things where that call almost worked, right? They were like a minute and a half from having pulled it off.
It's true.
But like those are the margins you're working with in F1. Now, Bottas, yeah, they definitely hung him out to dry. He had no value there as a tail gunner. But still, it's such an interesting case we're in F1 right now, where the best car is probably the Red Bull. It's good in different ways than the Mercedes. And so, like, everything counts in a way I don't think we've seen in a little bit. And so this whole thing was like, oh, this is going to be a fascinating season.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. The big feeling I felt at the end of this race was I think Red Bull should sign Perez for another year, at least. Like, he's exactly the driver that they need. He is dependable. He's got this ability to make tires last a long time. What do you think?
Yeah, I think at some point on this one, it dawned on me that in some ways, I think it's probably mentally a harder game to be the number two driver, because you often are dealing with the suboptimal strategy. The way that being like the top competitor sort of feeds your ego and like suits your training as a driver, that stuff all changes when you're a number two. And so I think you kind of have to be pretty psychologically tough to do it. And watching this race unfold, it's like there's not been a point, I think, in like the last two races, maybe three, where you've ever felt like Perez doesn't have it in hand. And that's not been true when they've been cycling a lot of younger drivers through, trying to figure out like the solution to the number two driver thing. And I think so much of that is just because you need to have it. It really helps to have a steady hand there who also isn't going to get in his head about like where he both stands within the team and about like how this race has gone for him and what he has to show. Perez just shows up there and gets the job done. And man,
yeah,
it generates the points.
Yep. Yeah. He is in third place. Max Verstappen is in first. So double points for Red Bull. This is the first time that Red Bull has won three races in a row in the turbo hybrid era, which I was surprised to learn. Lewis Hamilton brought it home in second place, and then his teammate in fourth, Valtteri Bottas. Behind them, Lando Norris in fifth, followed by Daniel Ricciardo in sixth. Then we've got Pierre Gasly in seventh, Fernando Alonso in eighth, Sebastian Vettel in ninth, and Lance Stroll from 19th place gets the final point in 10th. Behind them, Carlos Sainz, George Russell in 12th, tantalizingly close to points.
In a race with no retirements.
Yeah, boy, yeah, you're right. Yuki Tsunoda made his way up to 13th place. Esteban Ocon in 14th. Antonio Giovinazzi in 15th, followed by Leclerc in 16th. Raikkonen in 17th. Latifi in 18th. Schumacher in 19th. And Mazepin in 20th. I don't even think we got a yellow flag.
You know, no, I don't think we did.
Yeah. If you would have told me that not even a yellow flag at Paul Ricard and the race would still be good, I would not have believed you.
No, and Ferrari, like the drivers did just come off the track and they were like, yeah, the tires didn't work at all for Ferrari on race day. And so they're kind of trying to figure out where they've been left with these new pressures. But yeah, just not their day. I think on the one hand, it's a bit of like, it's tough to say, like this whole season, it's like, hey, Ferrari has a lot more pace than we thought. This felt a lot more like the Ferrari I've been expecting to see before the season. And so I am, again, super curious what the rest of the season holds, right? Is this kind of like, okay, well, now we are returning to more proper like race circuit configurations. Are we going to see that Ferrari kind of gasp and wheeze in these scenarios? Or did they just have an off day with different tire setup and a shift in the weather and it doesn't carry forward? Real curious.
Yeah, I read a little bit about, you know, people speculating why that was happening. And the scuttlebutt seems to be that Ferrari's tires have a very narrow window in which they can be fast. And it's difficult for the Ferrari car to get their tires into those temperatures because as a result of their lower power engine, they have to run lower downforce on their aerodynamics just to make sure that they go faster in a straight line. And as a result, you don't get the amount of downforce onto the tires that you may need to warm them up. But yeah, we'll see if that's something that they can make some adjustments to and come back. But for now, let's run down the driver's standings. Max Verstappen retains his lead of the driver's championship with 131 points. Lewis Hamilton is close behind with 119. Then Sergio Perez in third with 84 points. Lando Norris is in fourth with 76. Valtteri Bottas is in fifth with 59. Charles Leclerc with 52. Not bad considering both Ferraris were out of the points this week. So Sainz is right behind him with 42. Pierre Gasly is in eighth with 37. Daniel Ricciardo is in ninth with 34. Those two, I think, are not going to stay there. I think those two guys are going to move up. Sebastian Vettel's in 10th with 30. And then a bit of a jump down to Fernando Alonso in 11th with 17 points. His teammate Esteban Ocon has 12. Stroll has 10. Tsunoda has 8. And then we've got a tie for 15th place between Kimi Räikkönen and Giovinazzi with 1 point. Behind them, George Russell, Mick Schumacher, Nikita Mazepin, and Nicholas Latifi have 0 points. In constructor standings, Red Bull is on top with 215 points. Mercedes is in second with 178. McLaren is in a solid third with 110, followed by Ferrari with 94. I guess that's not too solid. AlphaTauri is in fifth with 45. Aston Martin has 40. That's going to be a nice battle this year, I think. Alpine's in seventh with 29. Alfa Romeo has 2. Williams and Haas have 0. And before we get to the news, I wanted to thank all of our patrons in the top tier. Jason Kelly, Will Rompf, Umberto Roca. So glad I get to say that name this week. Troy Stammer, Circuit Demon, Reagan, Sam G, Connor McManners, Joel Roberts, Abraham Getchell, Jason Chadwick, Abdullah Althani, Baileyfoot, Jack Ben, Greg Stolt, BPM, which stands for Bulls Pounce Mercedes, very apropos, Drew Stewart, Jack, I'm going to go with Mayhoff, and Simon Villeneuve. Thank you to all of our patrons for supporting us. But yes, now on to the news. Speaking of drivers, Esteban Ocon signed for 3 more years at Renault, which I was very happy to see. It's nice to not only have some stability, I think, for him, but also it feels more like he's like now in charge of his own destiny, because he was sort of passed around, kind of a Mercedes driver, kind of not. But now it seems like he's earned his seat there. He's secured himself. I don't know. I feel good about that.
No, his return was a little underwhelming. I thought he definitely deserved to stay in the sport when he ran out of a seat. His return was a touch underwhelming, but he seems to have really found his bearings at this point. And it's cool to see him get that vote of confidence.
Yeah. Wanted to do a follow up on those Baku tires. I think we mentioned a little bit previously in this episode. But yes, if you recall, Verstappen and Stroll's tires both exploded in the Baku race, and Pirelli did some investigations. There was some thinking that maybe they will say it's just debris, but they said that it wasn't debris and it wasn't a manufacturing defect. Pirelli would say that. They also said, though, that the teams had set up the tires correctly in the garage in terms of pressure and blanket temperature, but that running conditions are what caused the failures. I guess the implication being that the teams were doing something to the tires while they were on the cars to cause the failure, or some practice decreased the pressure that caused the failures. And you would want to, as a team, you would want to decrease the pressure because that gives you more grip. But the teams didn't, said that they followed Pirelli's guidelines. One thing that you can do is to remove the blankets early while your car is still sitting in the garage. And that will decrease the pressures, apparently. And this is something that Hamilton accused Red Bull of doing with Verstappen during qualifying in Spain. I believe that wasn't illegal at the point, but it is against kind of the spirit of the rules, I guess. But anyway, the FIA has updated the rules. They did so ahead of the French Grand Prix, which includes specifying that you can't do that. You can no longer remove the blankets early. More rules here from a breakdown over at the race. The tire pressures are also to be checked post-session to make sure that they're at the right pressure. No running of tire blankets overnight to increase heat, which I guess is something that they did. And no modifying the gas used to inflate the tires. So no putting helium in there, I guess. It sort of begs the question, like, why couldn't you then monitor the tire pressures during the race to be in a certain window? Teams have that capability. It's just not broadcast to us. But according to the race, they said that live running pressures, the readings would fluctuate pretty intensely, and so you wouldn't really have a number that's suitable for judging legality. But I don't know. With this, the teams don't want their tires to explode either, so maybe this is like a self-policing thing. I don't know. What's your take on all this, Rob?
Yeah, I think it's a tough situation because so much of this comes down to the tense relationship between Pirelli and F1, the teams. And to a degree, they're stuck with each other, and nobody's super happy with this. This goes back to the start of the Pirelli era, where the tires were underwhelming, and I think you had the chairman of Pirelli saying that, like, look, the brief we were given was to have tires that would wear away pretty quickly. We're being told to make a not great tire. What do you want from us? And I think that continues today, where, like, all the teams complain about, like, how finicky the tires are, how hard tire setup is. They're trying to find any kind of way to make these things work consistently for them. But then also you have this track record of really spectacular failures. And to some extent, it feels like you can't fully trust the tire guys because everything they say is a bit of a cover your ass, exercise. And so my suspicion is, like, this is not going to go away, that we're going to see a lot of the sort of distrust of, like, okay, well, what are people doing with their tires once they're in the garage? Like, is all that on the up and up? And the team's still kind of indicating that, no, there's probably something defective with the tires. And we're going to go back and forth on this. Hopefully the new spec, sorts that out. But nobody's been happy with that either. So we'll see.
Yeah, we are getting, not only will we have new cars next year, but we will be getting new wheels, 18-inch wheels, which look drastically different. So that will... It's all going to change next year. And speaking of that, there are images of a full-scale 2022 car mock-up floating around from the Italian website livegp.it. They've got some, they say, exclusive photos. The article claiming that the mock-up shown was commissioned by F1 to be revealed at Silverstone in a few weeks' time. It's funny, when I saw the original, like, 3D render that the FIA put out and said, here's, you know, what the regulations say, I thought it looked wild, like, super strange and weird. But actually seeing photographs of a full-size car, it doesn't look so crazy. I think it looks cool.
I don't know.
But,
I think it looks cool. To me, it still looks pretty crazy, though, too.
Okay.
Like, the snowplow front wing.
Yeah, that's a big...
Is wild. It feels like the nose goes on for, like, literal days. it could just be the angles they're shooting this car from. They're both, like, forward looking back on the car, and the lens might have a foreshortening effect. But the front of that car just looks like... It looks like an anteater. Really, it's wild. And those wheels are enormous.
Yeah.
By comparison. And so, yeah, I think it still looks great. Like, I think the thing has a really beautiful flow, to mm-hmm. it. It has that sort of, sort of aggressive, like flowing, forward-leaning look of a great sports car. But yeah, it looks so different now. Now, once we see the teams get their own aero crews over the spec, I'm sure. I bet you these things start looking a lot more like traditional F1 cars in short order. But yeah, the mock-up looks kind of cool. Also, looks really different.
Yeah, I think you're right that this will change once teams get a handle on it. I equate it to, like, when you watch a science fiction movie and the spacesuits look really cool, but then you look at NASA spacesuits and you're like, oh, well, this is what it looks like when it actually has to work.
Yes.
That's, I think, what might happen here. But I like it. I'm very excited for what real world 2022 cars look like. And we will have a link to that article in the show notes. Speaking of the look of cars, Mission Winnow has come off of the Ferrari cars for the European races. In a statement, Riccardo Parrino, the VP of Global Partnerships at Philip Morris, which is Mission Winnow, if you don't know, is a brand that Philip Morris started to be able to put their products on race cars because cigarette sponsorships are not allowed. So they just spun this up. And he says, Mission Winnow respects all laws and regulations and continuously strives to find distinctive ways to drive dialogue free of ideology and build strong partnerships that are rooted in shared values. Did a computer write this? We acknowledge
it's breathtaking.
It's so good. This part's great. We acknowledge the mistrust and abundance of skepticism towards our industry. However, our intention is not to create controversy around the application of the logo, but rather focus on reframing global conversations, building communities, and supporting innovative ideas that drive positive change.
I mean, this is the thing, like, this is where we're going to be with, like, petro firms in a few years too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where it's basically like, okay, so you guys are guilty of massive malfeasance, knowingly covering up just staggering harms to public health, and now you still want to be welcome you know, wherever advertising is shown, and you want us to view you not as what you've been historically and where your money actually comes from, but you want to be identified with some sort of nebulous set of values around, like, innovation and responsibility. I think the difference is, though, tobacco companies never really did have much going for them beyond, like, hey, how do we get people hooked on this shit? I think energy firms, that's how they rebrand themselves. We're not oil companies. We're not petrochem companies. We're energy companies. And I think they will probably be able to more successfully pull off this act where it's like, hey, we're just so high on innovation. We're just trying to build a better world. And I think for a lot of reasons, F1 will be eager to embrace that, so will European regulators to sort of pretend these, like, powerful entities are still valuable. Whereas I think tobacco is just kind of in a tough spot because, like, you know, we joked about it 2 years ago. What the hell was Mission Winnow? Never made any sense. It's always been, you know, corporate Mad Libs. And now, as they're once again sort of being punted out of the sport, you get these bizarre statements of non-purpose.
I guess not a bizarre statement. K-Mag, Kevin Magnussen, would be good at driving an Indy car. And it turns out he was. He filled in for the injured Felix Rosenquist in an Indy car race, I think just because he was in town. They put him in a car. I think he had like 30 laps or something to get used to it in practice. And then they put him in a race. He did qualifying. He started near the back of the field, but ran reasonably well. And I don't know. There's a really good breakdown of his race over at Race Fans. That we'll put a link in the show notes if you want to know more about it. But he seemed very excited about the whole thing. And there's also a really great video that we retweeted from the Shift F1 Twitter account that I will also link in the show notes, where he and Grosjean are chatting about the differences between F1 and IndyCar. I am fully on board with more F1 guys going to IndyCar. They just seem like they're having a great time, and they're fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's cool seeing these dudes who are like so easy to dismiss in F1, just because of like how stratified that sport is in terms of like the quality of ride you get. And it's cool to see these guys go over there and like you realize, no, they're stone cold. Right.
Yeah.
Like you put them in a more, more of a spec series, something a little more of a level playing field. And you can see like how quickly they can get up to speed and get the job done.
Yes. Yeah. More like this, please. And with that, let's move on to Austria. I did find one news story here, Rob, that is relevant to Austria. We will have two races back to back, the Steiermark Grand Prix, the Styrian Grand Prix, and then the Austrian Grand Prix, both at the same track, but we'll have different tires.
Okay.
The first one, we'll have the C2, C3, and C4 tires, which are in the middle of the five tire range, and then we'll get the softer C3, C4, and C5 for the Austrian Grand Prix. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm curious to see how that mixes things up.
Yeah. So take us through it.
Yeah. So this is, boy, it feels like we see this thing because they're using it as one of the places where they're double stacking races to handle the vagaries of the COVID era schedule. Feels like we're getting a lot of Austria lately. It's an historic track, but this layout is not particularly historic. So like a lot of tracks, its origins are, based on a local airfield racing circuit. But the old Österreichring, which is what it was, what the circuit was called before Red Bull took ownership and oversaw some substantial renovations. The Österreichring was probably a lot more like Spa in some ways, a lot more of your classic F1 type circuit where, here's a cool location near an old airbase, and we put a racing circuit around it. And it was dangerous as hell, and it only got more dangerous as the cars got faster. The modern circuit, if you sort of hold it in your head, the modern circuit is basically half of what the old circuit used to be. The old circuit used to have an entire section where right now there's the run off the straight, the start finish straight, and then you make a pretty quick, fast right hander. You used to continue on into what was called the Vosthugel turn. And that was just a sweeping right-hander that led you into this sort of backcountry part of the racetrack. And I pulled up old footage of it, and it is just one of it's like looking at old videos of Spa, where you're like, I can't believe they let dudes run there, because there's just huge portions of the track where basically you don't have a runoff. What you have is a dirt embankment. You're racing alongside a mountain. And if you run off the track, you are basically just going to run up a hill and get flipped on your head. And in the other places, the only concession to safety was like a single guardrail. So it became a really dangerous track. As speeds were increasing, you had a fatality with Mark Donahue, which basically caused that Vosthugel turn to be first turned into a chicane, but then kind of shut down entirely. The old configuration of the thing that really killed it was 1987. It just became clear you couldn't run a race there. The modern cars were too big. They could not. They had two accidents on the pit straight. And if you look at the replays of that, it's a traffic jam. They could not run modern F1 cars through there. And so the thing was kind of shuttered for a while until renovations were put in by, overseen by Herman Tilke. And what they kind of did was, as I alluded to, they cut away a lot of the track. They kind of cut it in half. And then what remains is they took the old layout. The old layout used to have a lot more, I guess you'd consider it more of a flowing layout, a lot of fast corners. What they've done instead is they've lopped off a lot of those corners and used the excess space for modern amounts of runoff and like crash barriers. And so you still have like the rough outline of the old circuit, which is a bit like, I guess you'd almost call it like shaped almost like an ampersand, where you have a narrow top loop and a fat bottom loop. And it still has that basic shape, but now there's just a lot more space to run off, and it's a much safer track. I will say, you look at old footage of the old circuit, that place looks cool as hell, but it's, all old circuits look awesome, and also I'd be terrified to race at them. yeah. And this was one such track.
And I'm not sure how exciting they would be in terms of, you know, passing and stuff like that. Maybe they'd be great. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like this circuit. It's small enough that you can kind of, it's probably a good one to go to in person, because you could probably see a lot of it from the stands, because it's all pretty compact. It's nice and undulating. It's nice to look at. And as I'm realizing, looking at the track map on Wikipedia, there is a turn called Power Horse, which is pretty good.
Which one is that?
Number 5, it seems.
That is, geez, okay. yeah, I'm looking at different, I've got a place with different names on them, so that's very funny. But yeah, so the other things that are notable about this circuit, though, the circuit is about 700 meters above sea level. That's about as high up in the mountains as Interlagos is. Mexico City is the highest place they race. It's 2,200 meters above sea level. But one of the differences, Red Bull Ring has really, as you said, undulating layout. There's 63 meters between the highest and lowest points on the circuit. But the main thing that is going on here is the altitude. Cars lose power at this altitude. Well, normally aspirated cars do, because air pressures are lower. And it's a bit like if you watch sports, like teams that play in venues at high altitude, it's a different challenge. Same principle exists for cars. The cars also gasp for air at altitude. F1 cars run turbos, so the air pressure doesn't quite affect them the same way, but the turbo is working much harder to compensate for that. And so it can be a really stressful circuit for the hardware. And that's become doubly true in recent years, because with the altitude, meaning that the circuit tends to run a bit cooler, but with climate change, meaning that you're having a lot of like freakishly hot days, this has become a really tough race to predict in terms of what race conditions are going to be. And so like last year, the first race they raced at, when they did the Austrian GP, the week before the Steiermark Grand Prix, only 11 cars finished that first race. Both Red Bulls retired. There were 11 DNFs, and almost all of them were different mechanical failures. And so, like, this circuit looks fairly unassuming, but it is a car killer. And the second race, there were much fewer DNFs, but that's because everyone was basically, like, fully reloading their cars with fresh equipment. Mercedes kind of dominated this race last year, in part because they had a good aero package and their reliability was through the roof. But the thing about this race is that it's tended to be, it's easy to say, well, it's a circuit where, because it's kind of short, because the straights aren't that long, it's not incredibly important, like how much power you have. But really, I look at the circuit as a place where you kind of can't have a weakness. You need to be able to make the most of those straights, and you need to be able to have low speed cornering for like the interior sector of the circuit. It kind of tests everything, and you're not really given much margin for error. So I think this is going to be another really good venue to see that Mercedes Red Bull shootout and where it's currently at. The other thing to watch out for, because it's kind of a shorter circuit, and because getting a toe down these short straights is so important, there's consistently qualifying chaos as cars stack up to try to get a favorable position. And there's almost always bad blood coming out of like Q1, Q2.
Well, Rob, there's one more factor that may be at play here this weekend. I'm just looking at the weather, and temperature-wise, we'll be in about the mid-70s Fahrenheit or low to mid-20s Celsius. Light wind, but at qualifying time, I'm seeing about a 60% chance of rain. The wind and temperature conditions, similar, maybe a little hotter, about 78 degrees Fahrenheit, I'm seeing, or 26 degrees Celsius. Precipitation climbs to 70% for the race. Very exciting. Oh, and thunderstorm, potentially, which honestly could cause a delay.
That shuts races down.
Yeah.
So
we don't want to get that. Yeah, wouldn't mind some rain.
Yeah.
It's always tough because we're predicting this so far in advance. But
yeah, God, I'm trying to remember, when's the last time I saw a rainy Austrian GP? I think it's been a few years. I think it's always been pretty, I feel like it's always pretty bright up there and pretty clear.
Yeah.
But I'm imagining, like, with rain and the amount of elevation change, I can only imagine parts of that track would just become a nightmare because of, like, the runoff.
Yes. I'm excited. I'm also excited to see how our fantasy league stacks up. If you'd like to join us, you can follow the link in the show notes for our official Formula One fantasy league. Yes, Formula One does fantasy sports. From France, here are the top three among our 3,557 teams. From Ireland, in third place, Checo, please. In second place this weekend from the United States, Max and Merck. And number one in the French Grand Prix from Norway, Sandra Bullock. Congratulations.
I mean, she's great.
Yeah.
Just a top flight actress.
America's sweetheart. Talent. Overall, though, in third place from Lithuania, Tuktuko Vairuotojai. In second place from the United States, Real Housewives of Monaco. And holding down the number one position from Canada, Ben Van Villeneuve. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do so at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or visit our website, f1.cool/emails. You can also hit us up on Twitter at shiftf1podcast. I'm at Drew Scanlon. That is at Rob Zachney. Danny O'Dwyer is at Danny O'Dwyer. That is us around the internet. Shall we take it around the world of racing? Let's do it.
Absolutely.
The World Rally Championship is in Nairobi for the Safari Rally Kenya. United States Formula 4 is at Mid-Ohio for their round 3. The Cabin World Trucks are at the Tricky Triangle, Pocono Raceway, for the CRC Bracklin 150. No idea what that is. The NASCAR Xfinity Series, also at Pocono, for the Pocono Green 225 recycled by JP Mascaro and Sons. Okay.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. And the W Series kicks off their season at the Red Bull Ring, supporting Formula One. We didn't have a W Series last year, and I missed it. It's fantastic racing. I would love to do, I haven't discussed this with you, Rob or Danny, but I would love to do some kind of Patreon thing where we go into the W Series, because I really enjoy it. MotoGP is at the TT Circuit Assen in the Netherlands. This is always a really fun race. The IMSA WeatherTech Championship is at the Watkins Glen International race course for Salen's 6 hours of the Glen. Motocross is happening in Great Britain. The MXGP of Great Britain is this weekend.
And we got NASCAR. I think we got two races in NASCAR this weekend.
We usually do.
That's what they do. Some kind of all-star. Is that happen? Anyway, two races that both have different names. We have on Saturday. The Pocono Organics CBD 325.
God damn it. Bring back Marlboro. Bring back Winston.
They had the last weekend was June 20th. Why didn't you put it there? Anyway,
and then on Sunday, explore the Pocono Mountains 350. A different kind of green.
Yeah.
And Formula One. That's right. We have another race this weekend. Friday, June 25th, things kick off free practice one. At 5:30 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2, followed by Free Practice 2 at 9 a.m. on ESPNU. Saturday, June 26th, Free Practice 3 is at 6 a.m. on ESPN2. Same channel, qualifying at 9 a.m. And the race, everyone, Sunday, June 27th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN. Final thoughts, Rob, of the first part of our triple header here.
Yeah, I think we are in for a really good title fight, both drivers and constructors. And I would have, until this last week, I would have said I had faith that Mercedes could like easily fend this challenge off, like that the machine is too well oiled. I'm a lot less confident now, and I think that's probably good for F1.
Agreed. Yes, I'm very much looking forward to the rest of this season. And Austria, if it's anything like last year, can really throw some wrenches into the machines. If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our Patreon episodes, you can do so over at patreon.com/shiftf1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week. Yeah.
It's actually more of an old school like Indy car. Really, they don't sound like that as much anymore.
It's real throaty, guttural. It's nice.
Yeah.